Hello and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week we take a tabletop RPG mechanic and read from the fucking manual that spawned it. My name is Sam Dunnewald and my co-host this week is Aaron King. If you're listening to this, there's a good chance you're already familiar with Aaron. They are the co-host of the RTFM podcast, where each week Aaron and Max Lander sit down and read a fucking manual so you don't have to. I've been on that show. We talked about errands. It was a good time. And I think Aaron King is quietly one of the most inventive and poetic designers out there right now, especially when it comes to designing moves from the Apocalypse World or Powered by the Apocalypse tradition of design. Now, what again is Apocalypse World? It's a post-apocalyptic game about scarcity by Vincent and McGay Baker and one of the most influential RPGs of all time. And what's a move? It's just like you'd think it'd be in a board game, like a little discrete action or bit of mechanics that you can make happen at the table. But sometimes these moves read like little poems. Like take Aaron's zine, Reading the Apocalypse, in which they take 28 of their favorite novels and write a custom move for each one that might exist in a game based on that book. They're so strange and beautiful, and they just make me want to sit down and play. And I say this not just to hype up my friend Aaron, but also to set the scene for the mechanic they brought in today. Love letters, a kind of custom move in Apocalypse World that the GM writes for their table after you've all been away for a while, kind of remind everyone what was going on and get the ball rolling again. I think writing custom moves is such a core part of Apocalypse World that's been overlooked by so many tables and games that came in its wake, and it was a privilege to get to talk about the practice with one of my favorite move writers. We also get into another overlooked topic, large amounts of time passing in the fiction, why that's super fun, and how to handle it with grace. Then we close out by writing our own love letter live on air for a game that we played together. It's a good time. This one is jam-packed, so let's get into it. Here is Aaron King with Love Letters.
Thank you for that beautiful and kind introduction you just gave me.
You're welcome, Aaron. Thanks for coming on the show.
Of course. I'm happy to be back for a first real episode. We've flirted, but now you've answered my love letter. Do you like me? Check yes or no. I'm here.
I checked yes. So before we get into love letters more specifically, let's talk about Apocalypse World. So most people probably know what Apocalypse World's deal is, who have somehow found their way to this arcane podcast. But where did Apocalypse World come from, as far as you understand it?
Yeah, Apocalypse World is by Vincent and Meg Baker. It was first published in 2010. That was the first edition. The second one was kickstarted in 2016, and that's the one we're focusing on today. Both of the Bakers were really active in The Forge, which was kind of a story games, let's upturn our understanding of RPGs forum. And I remember listening to an interview with the two of them. And even though I think Vincent Baker was only credited on the cover of the first one, like he's very vocal about, well, I wrote it like in conversation with Meg. And so I think he kind of said, like, I wrote the Brainer playbook, which is in here. And that was like the first discrete piece of this game. And it snowballed from there. It spawned the Powered by the Apocalypse design philosophy and mechanical niche. There are playbooks. There are moves. You're only ever rolling 2d6. These are some of the common features. Obviously, yeah. There's already haters out there telling me, well, hold on.
I was about to say, we're Powered by the Apocalypse is, again, if you're listening to this, you probably are familiar with the term, but is a broad enough school of design that we have already sort of just like whumped over two or three potholes in the road of what you were just saying. And we are going to just keep going. This episode is not about those potholes. This is as much as I will say about what we've skipped over. I think there are kind of two different understandings of what PBTA is. The first is games that look a lot like Apocalypse World, and that's a small number of player-facing moves, a different looking set of MC or GM-facing moves, some principles and so forth. You're rolling 2d6 plus a stat most of the time. Maybe you're rolling something plus something else, but for the most part, that's what the thing is. The other school of understanding what PBTA is as a philosophy of design. And that's a little bit more, I think, how we're going to be understanding it today, even though we're also talking about Apocalypse World very specifically as a game. Like, I think this concept of love letters, which I will explain in a moment, is something that could translate to really any system. Like, you could write Dungeons and Dragons love letters really easily.
Yeah.
And it's something that hasn't really escaped Apocalypse World itself. And in some ways, I find that interesting. It's almost more of like a GM advice thing than like a rule in the game, even though it is very mechanically laid out in the game.
Right. It's, I would say, if you're not familiar with Apocalypse World or love letters, something similar might be, well, every game can have downtime.
Mm.
Blades in the Dark has mechanized it in a really specific way. You could use that specific way in just about any game, but it's a way of approaching running and playing a game that I think a lot of people might even do naturally, and this is a specific way of doing it.
So let's stop beating around the bush. What are love letters?
Love letters are moves in Apocalypse World that you use to kind of cover the passage of time. They say in second edition specifically that they were written because they hadn't been able to play in a while and everyone needed a little bit of refresher. And instead of coming back and saying, do you remember it was this what happened? They wrote moves to cover maybe what had happened as this time passed as they weren't playing. Moves for each player. And so that's, I think, why they're called love letters, because it's a little kind of bespoke move for each of the players. And it covers things that happened in that time, but also served to remind you of like, oh, remember this person was kind of on your ass. Now they might be on your ass even harder.
Yeah, I want to situate them a little bit within the very specific context they are laid out in the book. So they're in the chapter called Advanced Fuckery, which is
one of my favorite chapter titles from an RPG.
Absolutely. And is also like a chapter that's basically just full of GM advice, I'd say. But also just a ton of encouragement to go out there and make your own moves and to like get your hands dirty, to get your bloody fingerprints on everything as a game designer almost in your home game of Apocalypse World.
I think Apocalypse World is like deceptively strict, like you are kind of supposed to be following these strict conversational rules, which I enjoy. And then the Advanced Fuckery chapter is like, all right, I know we're not always going to follow all these rules. Here's the ways to break them and bend them and play with them.
But I think it's also like, here's how you write more of those rules. Let's open the hood and let me show you how the engine of the game works and what it looks like if you get in there and try some stuff out.
And if you do it wrong, I am going to slam this hood down on your head like a fucking Breaking Bad episode or something. So look out.
I find it really interesting that the first thing in the chapter is like, here's a move that almost everyone who playtested the game asked for at some point. And the move is like, if things are really hard, you get a minus one. And if they're really, really hard, you get a minus two on your roll. And then it goes on and is like, listen, this move works totally fine. You can play with this, but everyone abandoned it eventually.
That move sucks.
That, like, you don't need it. And so it is, I think, simultaneously saying, listen, yeah, you want that move, here it is, it works totally fine, try it out for yourself. But I'm telling you, that's probably not the important thing about this game. And then it moves on to other things where it's like, these kinds of things are kind of important about the game. Like writing a custom move for Grome, I think is his name, is good at tying people to tables. It's like, here's a whole move about Grome tying people to tables, because he's really good at that.
And then also, I think there's like special moves for like certain areas. Like this is the like irradiated windswept spire.
Exactly.
The move for like dealing with dodging harm is not particularly applicable here. Let's write something a little bespoke.
Every time I read that chapter, my brain kind of explodes a little bit of like, oh right, the game actually is pretty insistent that you go out and write your own moves in this way. Like it really, really wants you to do that. And that is something that has not been absorbed into PBTA gameplay culture more broadly, I would say. Like very few other texts are really encouraging you to do that. And maybe this says something about my GMing style, but I have done very little writing custom moves when I have run these games because I find it scary and intimidating.
Max, my co-host on the RTFM podcast, is very vocal and insistent that moves are really hard to write. Mm. And I'm not foisting that on him as a way to say like I disagree with it or anything. I'm saying I'm very biased. I am a PBTA stan, you might say, and I love to write moves. I have real passion for it. That sounds stupid. Leave it in though.
No, I think it's true. Like, massive shout out to your zine Reading the Apocalypse, which is just a bunch of moves disconnected from any game based on whatever books you were reading at the time. They're so cool. And I don't know, I have heard you described as the only person who understands PBTA better than Meg and Vince.
Who said that? I'm coming out. I'm going to get their ass.
But I do think that you have a reputation as someone who is very comfortable writing PBTA.
I love it. I really like to do it. And I think part of that is I can sometimes draw a nice picture, but I hate drawing. It stresses me out.
Mm.
And mostly I draw a lot of bad pictures. And to get to the 1 out of 5 that looks fine to me is too stressful. Yeah. Whereas writing PBTA moves, I'm willing to just like throw trash at the wall, write a bunch of bad ones, get to some good ones. But we were talking about why people maybe don't write a lot of custom moves. I think they are hard. Like, there is a structure to them, the trigger. There's a specificity. It's really hard to have way too many words. And like that move you were mentioning that is in the start of this chapter, there are a lot of people that bring RPG hangups to a PBTA game and try to convert them. And I say this as someone who bought Dungeon World and was like, yeah, I'm gonna get in it now. I'm gonna ride the zeitgeist, and bounced off it and thought PBTA is not for me for years after that. I want to encourage people. I don't think it's hard, but also the hard part is like switching modes. It's like my favorite non-RPG podcast is called SF Ultra, and it's about reading and books and stuff. And he says everyone wants to read a poet's novel. No one wants to read a novelist's poems. And I think there's an aspect too, like if you're coming from these 300 page hardcovers and you're trying to write this little concise piece of game mechanic, that's a hard shift. Whereas if you're used to writing these really tight little game mechanics, like if you're spending a lot of time in the indie RPG scene, it's maybe easier to write these moves. And then maybe also you're writing cool things like Cyber Metal 2012 by Adam Vass.
Yeah. When I think about taking the leap from I am a dungeon master, I am a game master, I am the conduit for the game and the designer, to I am a designer myself, and like I am adding to the game that we are playing, I am changing it and modifying it in various ways, I think about the legendary tweet from at Yellow Cardigan. My therapist laughs at joke I just said. Me to myself, this is great. I'm going to get a good grade in therapy. It's something that is both normal to want and possible to achieve. And I think about it in the context of becoming a game designer, right? Like, I think that there was, for me at least, a long time mental block around the game is this artifact from God, right? Like, I'm coming out of the Dungeons and Dragons world where the game, it was handed down from 50 years of history by titans like Chris Perkins and Gary Gygax and whoever the fuck else is making that game, and like I better not fuck it up. And then I don't know, I just did this whole episode with Emma Costa about Rule Zero and how even Dungeons and Dragons is out here telling you should get your hands in and fuck around with this. And the best sessions of D&D that I've played are the ones where like we never rolled a single die because I brought some bespoke mechanic, or the DM brought in play scripts for all of us to read because we'd been accosted by a traveling theater troupe that needed actors or whatever. And it just, the table gets so much better when you get to design for your people, for your friends. Like, the people in the ivory tower of Wizards of the Coast can't do that. And yeah. So even if you do a mediocre job, the fact that it's bespoke is going to be so much more memorable at the very least.
But then you have the other side of it, which is someone complaining on Reddit about,
mm-hmm.
I started a new game and someone brought a Vegeta Super Saiyan class from dndwiki.wiki.whatever, and like the homebrew has gone too far.
it is about like getting on the same page as your players, right? But I think this is actually something, to bring it back to Apocalypse World, that Apocalypse World does really well, where it says, listen, the basic moves and stuff, like, you don't want to replace those until you kind of really know what you're doing. Like, there are tenants here that you don't want to fuck with. But, like, we, the Bakers, have left very clear gaps for you to fill in with a very manageable amount of custom move. And it would be fun for you, maybe, to just try filling those things in. Maybe, you know, maybe you just want to try that out for a little bit.
Yeah. And love letters are one form of those custom moves.
To actually finish setting up love letters, let me get in here and read actually some text from the book. And then we can look at one of the examples from the book, too. So the game, this is the other thing about the book. There's two paragraphs here I'm about to read. They have some examples in the middle. And this is the entirety of how love letters are presented in the book. Here's a batch of custom setup moves. They're from a game I ran where we missed several weeks in a row. Our collective memory was running dim and we'd lost collective momentum. So when we finally came back together to play, I passed these out. They refer to people and events we'd already established in play. Examples. They worked perfectly. They reminded us what we had going on and kicked us into the new session with shit already happening. Custom moves can be large scale, situational, personal, and single use. You can use love letters to kick off a session.
All right, I'm going to read two, including the one you included in the show notes. I'm going to read that one first.
Great.
Dear Keeler, please roll plus cool. On a 10 plus, choose one. On a 7 to 9, choose two. One, the headaches are getting seriously worse. Two, you're missing times, sometimes hours out of a day, more and more. Three, you've been eating some really weird ass stuff. On a miss, I'll choose two for you. And then another.
It's important, I think, to end this with love and kisses.
I was gonna get to that after, but yeah, each of these ends with love and kisses, your MC. And then the third one is, dear Rose, please roll plus hard. On a 10 plus, choose one. On a 7 to 9, choose two. One, your mother has people hanging around your place, keeping a watch out for Keeler. Two, H has started doing what L tells him to do. Three, you've been totally relying on Gams for fresh veg. On a miss, yeah, pretty much all three. So the first one is all about Keeler's internal life, which is why I'm less into it.
Yeah.
The other one I read is all about the world, the player noticing things about the world and the world reacting to that player character. I don't think one, I mean, this is from a bespoke specific campaign. So I think the first one's probably really good for that situation, whatever was going on. But to me, love letters really shine when they say, remember all these things that were happening? Remember the power you had over them? Here is a way to play with increasing and decreasing your power over these things that were in play while also reminding you what was going on.
Yeah. I mean, I think the text that I read out lays that out really clearly, that they are about sort of reclaiming the momentum we had whenever we last played and like kicking things off again. And I find that my biggest problem with Apocalypse World and most other PBTA games that I've played is once I get rolling in the rhythm of things with people, they're really easy to keep up and I love playing them. But it is really hard to kick off with that momentum. And reading these in preparation for this episode, I was like, oh yeah, I should just be starting campaigns with these fucking things. They do seem so good at doing exactly what you're talking about, of like reminding people, here's what's going on around in the world, but then also basically picking some of the clocks, which are a tool the MC has on the back end to sort of track how things are getting worse in the world and what people are up to. And you can just kind of like grind some of those clocks forward, make things a little bit worse for everyone, and then figure out what happens next. And yeah, they're really, really lovely for that.
Yeah, and they're also a tool for showing a player's interest, right? Like if you tell the player in your love letter, this person that was onto you is more onto you, you can choose that or not. This person who was, you know, you were relying on is maybe a little sketchy or not, blah, blah, blah. Like it lets them pick, oh, this is actually the story I'm interested in pursuing.
Yeah, that's a great point. That the Rose one, where it's three options about other people and Rose's relationships to them, is not written in a way where it's like, on a 10 plus, your mom has been helping you. On a 7 to 9, your mom's been being a little weird. On a 6 minus, your mom has been kidnapped or whatever, or your mom is like being really mean. Because it's three different plots, it does exactly what you were saying of allowing the player some agency in what the story is going to be coming up.
And if they roll well, the plot they pick is the only one that's really progressed since the last time they played. If they roll poorly, all three of those plots have moved on, which is like kind of stressful for me as a player to say like, oh, I missed my chance to like stop all three of these. Like if I had been on my game, if we had been meeting regularly, could I have been interacting with all of these and slowing them down?
But that's what Apocalypse World is all about. Like that particular feeling of stress is the feeling Apocalypse World is trying to engender in you as a player.
Yeah. Hard for some people. I say like as someone who maybe would like to keep track of all these plots in a game that I'm playing, and also as someone who like runs a lot of games for people with different like stress disorders and stuff, like the idea of moving plots behind the curtain can be a little scary and a little stressful, which if you're all on board, good. But
yeah, I want to appreciate the format of these love letters. That is a format you see in a lot of Apocalypse World, where it's sort of like, here are 3 to 4 bad things that could happen, or 3 to 4 good things that could happen. On a 10 plus, you get to choose like 3 out of 4 are good. On a 7 to 9, you get to choose like 2 out of 4 are good. And on a miss, the MC gets to choose like what the hell bad is going on. And that format of choice is so much fun.
And I think couching that in the clear GM moves, MC moves of Apocalypse World is really nice. I've certainly played D&D where we go off after something, and because we chose that, this other thing is happening. But there were no kind of mechanical dramatic tools to tell us that that was the choice we were making. And so the idea of kind of saying like, well, this happened because you rolled a 6 or less, or you looked to the GM and the GM got to make a move in response and then use their move for tell future badness to describe to you this faction making their next step or something. I think that kind of stuff is why people insist on trying to run Apocalypse World strictly by the rules, is because it feels good to get fucked over that way. It feels good to pursue this thing and do poorly and then have the GM say, oh, back home, this thing goes wrong. That feels much nicer than just, oh, we went and we killed the dragon, and then the GM says, your house is on fire. And it's like, what? What?
I'm reminded of how the Bakers have, I believe, both been like sex education teachers in the past. And both have talked about how much of that work and sort of always acquiring consent is something they tried to bake into the rules of Apocalypse World. It's very much possible that you will be fucked over, but they are putting the manner of your being fucked over in your hands a lot of the time. The like person who's getting fucked over often gets to choose how they're getting fucked over.
That's the basic fuckery.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why we have the advanced fuckery chapter.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, it's very clear when you read these letters before you roll, like, this is what's going to happen. And if you had a problem with it, like, I think you could check in and be like, you could voice, it's really easy to imagine, like, the player behind Rose getting to the table and reading these over and being like, oh no, like, is this really what's going on? And you could like put in the air either your anxiousness about that the table can have a conversation about, or your excitement about that and the table gets to have a conversation about that. And writing the move out in advance lets everyone sort of have that meta level conversation implicitly, if nothing else, just by virtue of the existence of the love letter.
Yeah, I think that leads to an important distinction between love letters and other moves in Apocalypse World, which is that other moves in Apocalypse World have a trigger, like when you read a charge situation. Mm-hmm. And so there are many times in the rule book where someone says, like, I want more information on this. I want to read a charge situation. And the MC says, oh, I didn't think of this situation as charged. Is it charged to you? And the player goes, oh, no, no, no. I just wanted to know X. And then the MC's like, oh, yeah, I'll just answer that then.
Yeah.
No move required. So like stepping up to that trigger, understanding it, making it explicit, and being able to say, oh, actually, my character, I don't think is doing that. there's no trigger like that in this, which is like an interesting wrinkle to me. It's just you arrive, I say, roll the dice. I like it. I wouldn't want it all the time. I hate to play a PBTA when someone's like, just roll plus sharp. And it's like, why? What am I triggering? And they're like, just do it.
The trigger for these is kind of, it's been a long time since we last played. Yeah. Like no one remembers what's going on. Like I've seen people say like, oh, move triggers should always be fictional, but that's just not true in basic Apocalypse World, even outside of Love Letters.
Right. At the start of a session, roll plus XYZ.
Exactly. Exactly. And these are essentially start a session moves that you are just going to do one time based on whatever was going on in the fiction last time.
As a GM, I love there to be at least one at start of session roll X move amongst any group that I'm running games for. It does what these love letters do, which is it says like, we're jumping in. This is the ritual. This is starting the game. Someone's going to roll and we're going to get a change to the status quo. And sometimes that prompts like, oh, at the start of session roll X on a 6-, resources missing. And then you start talking about like, oh, where were we last time? What's a good resource to be low on? They are such a helpful little ritual session starter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, you! You don't look familiar. First time in this part of the city? I see that sneer on your face. Better wipe it off before I do it for you. This is home. This is the best place you could ever want to be. Whether or not this is where you meant to end up, you found yourself on a rather fortuitous street. You see that corner building down there? 3 floors up. Lamplight Investigative Services. Friends of mine, you ask. Loaded words you're throwing around this evening. Good people is what they are, though. Not a single one of them will admit to being nice. Something about duty, yada yada. A bunch of BS, if I do say so myself. Who am I? No need to worry your pretty little head about that. I'm sure my name will come up in time. But go. See for yourself. 3 floors up. Gold-gilded sign. As for Mama, don't tell him I sent you. She'll know what to do.
All doors are just windows that we can't see through. You ever think about that?
We provide our patrons with anonymity.
Hello, this is Mama Amoretta speaking.
Lamplight Investigations, a Thirsty Sword Lesbian's noir mystery. Full season available now on QueerPG.
I think we would be remiss if we did not touch on the kind of cheeky way in which these letters are written. Like, I love all of them ending with love and kisses, your MC. Like, that really sets the tone for, yeah, I'm, like, fucking you over here, but, like, also, that's my job, and, like, we're here to have fun. I see you, and I love you, and I'm teasing you. But I also love, dear Keeler, please roll plus cool. Something about please in there.
Yes.
Is real. It's like the trigger is, I would like this to happen now. Are you on
please.
Board with that? Like,
please.
And I think that kind of ties into the thing we were just talking about of what is the trigger for this move? Like, it's the start of session. But this is, the please is almost like this implicit asking for permission to, like, add this new one-time start of session move.
And I could see, if I were in a group with these people, I could see someone being like, I'm feeling overwhelmed by all these love letters. Can we just do 2 of them? And love and kisses, yeah, let's do 2.
Yeah, and I think it would be nice to have a little bit more explicitness to that, I think. The rules text lays out all these example letters that are all basically formatted like the 2 that we read out. But you can imagine writing love letters that look completely differently. Like, you can imagine them the way I was talking about, where you take a single issue and then roll dice to see how it's going. I think that would be less interesting than these. But you could also imagine doing something like this, but aiming it at the whole group all at once. Like, all right, someone, like, nominate a leader for the group. They're going to roll plus weird. And then you're going to choose two of the PCs to have weird shit going on. And that would maybe bring in some of that, like, ooh, if someone wants to opt out, they can lobby for that and probably get. But there's a lot of ways I think you could write love letters.
One thing I love is that a lot of people coming from traditional RPGs, skill-based, I'm going to call them, but not in a player skill way, but like, my character sheet is a list of skills. They say, well, moves are just like skills, but they have specific uses. And one thing I like about love letters is, like, this is not a skill list. This is not your deception skill or anything like that. And so I think it really helps situate moves as a little fucking trap that you step on in the narrative that makes things more interesting. Sometimes it's more interesting in your favor. You, like, get this big power over someone and you have to decide how to use it. Sometimes more interesting in, you know, not in your character's favor. You are dangling from a collapsing bridge or whatever. But
yeah,
none of this has to do with how good your character is at something or what they know. And they all have to do with what are you entangled in and how can those entanglements keep the game moving in a way that keeps people from just thinking, well, I've solved it. I'm fine now. We can all relax.
I love that metaphor of moves as a little bear trap that you step on. That feels so useful as a way to think about how to deploy moves and when to deploy moves.
And sometimes you see the bear trap and you get to have it and throw it at someone else.
Oh, yeah. Let me go stomp on that shit. That sounds fun.
I want this person to catch up to me. I want to see what happens when I'm at their mercy.
Like, they're bear traps for the little dolls that we are moving through the story, right? And maybe you feel really precious about your doll, but I don't know, maybe you get the most fun out of stitching your doll's leg back on like me.
Right, and like all of the moves that I am excited to engage with are not, oh, I get to deal one harm to you, or you get to deal one harm to the bad guy, or you get to seize what you're seeking. But they are like, here's a new weird fucked up thing that's about to happen. It's, you know, toss this ball. We're all juggling them together. There's another one in the air now and we're waiting for it to drop. And I think that is where the juice for designing moves at your table is just like, what are they interested in? How can I write a move that is exciting to step on? And when they do, gives them some great choices of what to toss into the air for like, we're all dealing with this now. You all thought mushrooms were cool. Now there's a fungal weirdness that is in the air and just an invitation to kick it and see what comes out.
So another very big and obvious component of love letters that we have touched on but not gone deep on is how much they are a mechanic about time passing in the middle of RPGs. I think they are interesting in that they are both about time passing in the fictional world and about time passing in the real world, right? That's the recommended sort of origin for them, right? As you come back after a long time away, having not played, and you write some of these to get back into the swing of things. But I think time passing in RPGs is a really interesting thing that does not happen very often, like most games do not make space for. And I'm curious what kind of thoughts you have about it.
Yeah, I don't think I thought about this much until I was running a long-ish campaign of Sagas of the Icelanders, which is like a second-generation PBTA following up quickly on Apocalypse World. And one of the MC moves, one of the GM moves, is the season changes. So if at any time the players look to you, or if they roll poorly, you can just say, summer becomes fall. And this first came up because we were in this kind of chaotic situation and someone rolled really poorly. I was like, I don't even know what to make happen here. I looked at my list of GM moves and I thought, maybe the season changes. And it changes from summer to fall. It is now like 3 months later. And I brought up kind of softly, like, this is kind of what I want to do. None of your characters are dead or anything, but like, I'm really intrigued by your responses if everything that just happened, this chaotic, semi-violent situation, is all of a sudden 3 months in the past. And they were like, yes, let's do it. And we'll talk about it. But you know, we started down that path and immediately someone's like, well, wait, what about this other thing that we were involved in? What about this other thing that my character had going as a side gig? How did that happen? And to a player, I think any player who is given this position of you can control one character's actions, someone else controls one character's actions, and then there's someone in charge of like everybody else, it's kind of weird to go, there are 3 months that happened to your character where you did not get any input, even though that's your kind of only tool in the box. I don't think any of this is perfect, but it feels very fruitful to me to say, what if when something bad happens, you just have to deal with it 3 months later? Like, as someone with depression, I'm like, oh, I know the thing about a bad thing happens to me. And then 3 months later, I'm in bed thinking about it still. And maybe not a lot has changed for me. And so the power of the love letter to say, all this time has passed, you must choose the one thing that you had power over. Is it that you're preventing H and L from having a lookout on your friend's house or whatever it was in the love letter? Bridges that gap for me, and also keeps a game from devolving into you enter town and I, the GM, want to fast forward to you get to the reception, the dance at the princess's hall or whatever, but they all want to go, well, what kind of town? What do the streets look like? Oh, I'm out of rations. Can I buy some rations quick? To be able to say, you get to town and the princess's ball is this, and have some mechanics to elide those things I'm less interested in.
Yeah, it is certainly a loss of control on the player's side, like you're describing. I think it is really interesting the manner in which you're right, love letters bring back some of that control by allowing you to pick one of the problems that you have dealt with, probably. But I also think about, I remember you telling that story that of the Sagas of the Icelanders moment on RTFM, I believe, and it conjuring up in me the famous cut in 2001 A Space Odyssey, right? Like cutting from a bone from pre-caveman to like space station is a hell of a cut. A lot of time passed. We're all playing new characters now, right? And I think that can be such a effective and compelling storytelling device. It's really, really, really cool to see it mechanized and to imagine a playgroup that is cool with it, right? Like, I don't think you would want to do that without the sort of soft launching it with your players first, like checking in with everyone.
Like in a movie, there's no writer in the writer's room or person in the audience who is in control of one character and thus loses control. Like, that's the distinction. And the other thing is that the movie can set the stakes in a way. Like, no one's like, oh, Fast and the Furious 7 ended, and then 8 begins a year later. No one's like, wait, but what did Dom Toretto shop for at Walmart? Like, did he get the juice?
Did he get more Corona?
Exactly. Like, thank you for remembering such a specific part of the movie.
The Corona juice.
The Dom Nos, as it is called. Yeah, and so like they can set things up before that match gets lit to make it pleasing to jump 30 years in the future, whereas that can be harder with a group of players.
Yeah, but that's what makes love letters such a cool tool, is that they allow for the smoothing over of that, right? They allow for the players to have input on that, to get everyone on the same page. In some ways, like, love letters are really more like an airbag when you brace for impact on the other side of that. Like, it's already happened that a bunch of time has passed.
We've missed,
right?
3 sessions in a row. It's been 2 months. What the fuck is going on? Let's just pick one cool thing to go forward on.
But something that would be really cool to me is a version of this kind of move that is more active, is something that you might imagine deploying in the middle of a session because that's cool.
Every time a character achieves their goals, issue love letters is like an MC move, potentially.
So the last thing that I wanted to do was maybe try to like write a love letter on air. We recently like wrapped up a little Apocalypse World campaign, and I think we could do a little bit of setup for what was going on at the end of it and maybe try to write a love letter for it. But before we get into that, I also wanted to ask you, as someone who loves writing moves, when you are going to write a custom move, what are you thinking about? And why are you writing any particular custom move as opposed to any other? Like that's another thing that feels overwhelming to me when I sit down to be like, ooh, it'd be fun to write some custom moves for the game, is where do you start?
I generally kind of divide a lot of these moves into two very broad categories to start with, which is like, one, there's an archetype, a genre action, or like a failed D&Dism that I want to address and make fun. Someone is like, oh, if you are in a game of D&D and you're trying to sneak, it sucks that one of you has stealth plus 20 and then one of you has stealth minus 1.
Yeah.
It means you have to break up. It means you have to like figure out, wait, do we all roll? Does one of us roll? And so like one way to address writing a specific move is like when you sneak through the whatever, whatever, roll on a big success, bring someone with you. You can choose this multiple times, choose three or whatever. That's like just a very basic genre demand, is that someone is like, come this way. I know how to sneak. Let me show you. And that could maybe also be handled on like defy danger plus a help action. That seems very complicated. Also, people love to be sneaky. Like that's a very common archetype that people come to a game wanting to tap into.
Yeah.
And then the other one is like, I'm a freak for hyper-specific love letter moves as a move you can just take. And I like that because it's a signal to say, I want to start a story. We're in the middle of this game. I have a move that lets me summon my three fellow broom-riding witch freaks and lets me fly around on a broom. It's not just the flight that it grants me, which is fun and cool on its own, but also implies like there's these other people out there.
Yeah.
Why do I know them? How do I know them? And then maybe the more you use this move, they make more demands of you, and then you check off.
Yeah.
Something as you go through, and then at the end you have to reinvest in your relationship with the broom riding freaks or something.
Earlier we were talking about this metaphor of almost like juggling, like what are the players currently juggling and what are they interested in juggling? Like I think of, you know, your job as a GM sometimes is to just like throw a bunch of shit at the players and see what they are interested in picking up and running with. Apocalypse World even says this straight up, like figuring out what they've picked up and then write a custom move for that thing, whether it's the monster in the lake or it is Grom and his way of tying people to tables or Rose's mom or whatever. That feels like the place to write custom moves. I listened to Mike Birbiglia's podcast, who's a stand-up comedian, and the podcast is a lot about process. And he has this piece of advice that when you are coming up as a stand-up and you have like 5 minutes of material and a minute of it is really good and like 3 minutes of it are okay and 1 minute of it is bad, instead of like trying to make your bad stuff better, the actual thing you should do is work on the good stuff. Because that's good, and that probably means there's like more to be mined there.
Oh.
I think that metaphor is really, really great as a creative at large. But I also think it's really, really applicable to writing moves here of whatever it is that is working well in the game, that's what you want to write moves about, because that's going to like pull people in and make them want to trigger those moves. Or even just like putting the move on the table is going to add to the mystique and the fun of those moves. Like,
yeah,
you and I are playing in a game of Pasión de las Pasiones right now that is Adam's Family themed. And in the group chat for this game, you just posted, I'm just trying to write some playset moves. And the first one is the thing in the lake. When you bring someone to the edge of the lake to help you feed the fish, roll with the questions. Can you lure them onto the dock and are they distracted? On a 7-9, choose one. You push them into the lake, but they leave evidence behind or shout to attract attention before being consumed. Number two, they catch you trying to push them and have time to react. And then there's more to it too, but even just that much, I was like, I gotta push someone in this fucking lake. Like the whole session we were playing, I was like, who can I find to put in this lake? I gotta go put someone in this fucking lake. And that is, first of all, the power of a cool move, right? I think
the power's in the trigger.
Exactly. You were interested in this lake, and so you wrote a cool move to sort of tempt people down to it. But also, it's easy to imagine me having already befriended the monster in the lake, and then you write this move, and suddenly it's like, oh, that monster's not going away. Like, we wrote a whole move for it. We're like, we're right. all at the table excited about that monster. And
it's the write-off character from season one that the fans loved.
Yeah,
it's like,
exactly.
All right, we got to bring that guy back. What's the story?
Yeah, yeah, totally.
And I think the other thing I want to bring up with that is like trying to mechanize or standardize player behavior.
Mm.
So I ran D&D 5e for like 6 years, and you get to know these people, like for the same group. And they always want to do something, and there's never a rule about making friends, or there's bad rules. It's just like roll persuasion or whatever. And so you want to create something for them that's like, hey, I see you freaking out about making friends with all these people. Here is a way to say you can make friends with people, but here are some potential complications. Here are some ways you can do it with no attachments, and they are your friend, et cetera, et cetera. Like, what if we made this a mini game? And that's what a love letter is as well. Just like a mini game that you play that follows the same conventions as a normal move. But like, we're breaking time out strangely, and we're giving you specific goals and consequences. Well, so can I be... I've dodged self-promotion so many times.
Please.
In a game I wrote called Patrick World, which I'm sure I would disown at this point if I read it again, there is a move called Resurrectionist, which is inspired by the video game Planescape Torment, but it reads, when you discover that you're cursed with unending resurrection, gain 1d6 hold, spend one hold for an NPC to have known you in a past life. When you do mark stress, stress is a thing in there, and then roll, plus the stress you marked, on a success, choose one. They feel honor-bound to help you. You recall something embarrassing or damaging about them. They've been saving an important item or piece of information for you. So this is like, then there's a 7 to 9. There's a list of bad stuff to happen. But it's a way to say like, hey, if you're the kind of player that just like saying, this guy we just met, he's my friend. Oh, this reporter that we're talking to, it's my ex-wife. Like, if you are that kind of player, here's a way to just invest you with that power.
Yeah.
And you never have to like look at me and be like, is that right? You could just say, this is someone that has been holding something for me.
Yeah, that's another cool way of thinking about custom moves, as a way of giving players agency in the way you want to give them agency. That sometimes GMing is really hard, and I think some of the best GMing advice is when you're stuck, just like ask the table for ideas, because, you know, this whole thing is a collaborative experience, right? Just because you have an asymmetric job doesn't mean you can't ask for ideas. And it's so plays writing a good custom move is being like, you can have the ideas for this thing. I don't want it.
I see your weird little freak thing about trying to kiss everyone you meet. Like, here's a way to get kiss points and choose which ones you spend them on. And here's a way to list the consequences very clearly. Your home is not going to burn down if you're bad at kissing, but one of your other kissies might get mad. That makes sense, right?
Yeah. So I wrote some bullet points in the outline here that I'm just now revisiting, and I think they're pretty good, so I'm going to read them off. So I wrote, like, writing custom moves, why do it? And one is, I think we've covered extensively, you know your table better than any designer and can design to your players' particular quirks. That's fun. And two is, you can point to something and say, this thing is special, pay attention to it. And sometimes you're doing that after other people have decided that it's special and they like it.
It's fun. A companion to the X card. Turn the volume on this one up, please. We want to have more of this.
Sometimes it's just fun. Sometimes you just like want to put your own little flair on things, or you had a cool little idea. I guess that's kind of the similar. But the last thing I wrote in here is, I just watched the 3rd season of The Bear, which is a show that I really love because it's good. And the 3rd season...
I've only seen season one, so feel free to spoil it.
Season 2, I think, is one of the better seasons of television I have ever seen. And there's a character in season 2 who learns to appreciate the grace and love and beauty and self-worth that you gain by acts of service, like helping other people and just being there to make other people's lives better. And I think that that's a really wonderful idea. And that is what I try to do as a player in role-playing games these days, regardless of whether I'm GMing or playing. I'm always either really tired or I'm looking at the other players and I'm saying, like, what does this person seem to be really excited about right now? What do they want to happen? And how can I make something surprising happen that will like complicate that in a way that they will find delightful? And I think custom moves are a great way to do that as a GM, right? To say, I see what you love in this story, and I am going to underline it and try to make it even better for you.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's try writing a love letter. I think you have the notes for this. I am the player who does not have notes and does not remember what the hell happened 2 months ago when we finished this thing. Do you want to tell me about it?
Yeah. I mean, I bragged about having notes and now I can't fucking find them. we had three players. One ended by angering many different people. One ended by making a maybe potentially dangerous alliance with some plants. And you ended by being banished to the psychic maelstrom and then coming back different.
That's right. Yeah. I was a weird little freak who became a weird little monster freak.
And so I think you were kind of a mechanic who was interested in the mechanics of psychic something, and you got banished to the psychic maelstrom, and then you came back changed, strange, more able to interact with the psychic maelstrom. So Ty was stuck in this otherworldly realm, busted on through with some changes, a new understanding of the realm and herself. And so my idea was for a love letter, if we ever do quote-unquote season two for this, we come back and, busting through a barrier to another spirit realm, I feel like something's got to change. So that's my initial idea of like, oh, this is now a more permeable barrier. Does something come after you? Is there a new connection, a sort of permanent connection that could be made? And so I started with like, there's some other entity involved, and it was going to be a sort of role plus weird, unconnected to the role. Choose, is it an entity native to the astral plane? Is it an entity that has from our world but has been there for a long time? You know, the same way that character creation has like, choose your look, choose your whatever. So we build this creature together, and then you roll. And based on the role, like on a 10 plus, you know where it is, it thinks fondly of you, and it will speak to you before it acts kind of thing is my choose three of like, what's the best situation? That's my bullet point in my notes. And then so the idea of like choose two, maybe you don't know where it is, or maybe it will not speak to you before acting. You know, like,
yeah.
What are these helpful subtractions you can make from these lists of traits that have bigger implications that aren't necessarily, oh no, crisis. It might act in like a really kindly way, but it will be a surprise to you and to everyone else kind of thing.
And sometimes the wrong kindness at the wrong time can really fuck up your plans.
I'm sure that's never happened to you in real life.
Never. I mean, especially as a player who loves to get down in the shit and step on all those bear traps, I think this feels like the kind of move where even on a 10 plus, there should be some sort of problem associated with it, or like one of these things should not be achievable.
Oh, I think, yeah, I'm not opposed to that. I agree with you. I also love the idea of, I like the idea of player wins, like granting a player like kind of a full win, but then having that thing just hovering. Like if you know what it is, you know where it is, and it will come to you before it acts. That all feels good. And then if you roll poorly in the future, I have it come to you before it acts. And it's like, oh, I am going to drink all the blood out of this person you really like. And it's like, oh, you know what it is and where it is. Then that becomes, do you negotiate it with this now? Do you go to its base? Do you tell someone else? Like,
you go have one last drink with that person before all their blood gets sucked.
Yeah. So you can have all the information and get a win, and still have it be this kind of ominous buzzing above the campaign.
It's interesting that we spent the beginning of our time talking about love letters being like, they're all written where there are three different things on three different plot lines going on, and you kind of get to choose which ones you're going to focus on. There's this obvious idea that you could write a move where there's one plot line that's featured. On a 10 plus, things are pretty good with it. On a 7 to 9, things are okay with it. 6 minus, things are bad with it. And I was like, yeah, I think that's kind of like the worst kind of these. I think the more plot lines is better. And then we come back in and the one that we're writing at the end is exactly that kind, but also it sounds fucking great. I love it.
I want a weird creature. Yeah. And I mean, yeah. The juice also would just be in this pick list of you getting totally. To say, like, it has phosphorescent antlers.
Yeah.
Its cloak is shimmering like an oil stain, whatever, whatever. And that would be the love letter service process of me trying to say, what do I know about Sam? How can I write just like my best little lines of prose to be exciting to pick? I don't want any of them to be duds. Like you were saying with Mike Birbiglia, how do I write 9 things in 3 columns where each one is fun and you get to pick and then you tell all the players.
Yeah.
It's this, you know, cat mouthed, whatever, whatever.
And that's a great way to do. Sometimes as a GM, you do just want to say, I have a cool idea and it's happening now. There's a monster in this lake, deal with it. And this is a really great way for you to introduce that while giving me, the player, a lot of agency over that thing since it's going to affect my character a lot.
Yeah. They're your new buddy.
Yeah. I can't wait to meet them. This move already, just in its most draft form, already makes me go, we got to go back and play more of that game. I need my weird little phosphorescent antlers guy. Like, let's do
it. Yeah, it was a fun game. The one I was like trying to figure out for Keegan was, Keegan's character had kind of angered multiple factions. And so I wanted to, another approach to these moves I have is like, what are the weird levers you can pull on in this game? And so one is like stats. You don't have that many stats. They have pretty clear definitions. And since Keegan had 3 factions that they were in a weird limbo with, I wanted to say, like, pick a faction, roll with that in associated stat. And so there was, like, a kind of gang that they had left on weird terms with. And so if they wanted to shine the spotlight over there, they would be rolling with plus hot or whatever. And then if, you know, there were these spirit wasps, and if you wanted to deal with that, roll plus weird. And then the pick list would be the same of, like, they hate you. They love you, whatever, whatever. But by choosing which stat you roll, you know the probabilities of that roll. Some stats will be better. And that creates tension of like, well, but my best stat is not necessarily the faction I want to come back. I get to pick and I get to define where the spotlight goes.
I would take that situation for Keegan and I would just write a diceless move. I would just be like, fuck, marry, kill these 3 factions. Like, you are 100% going to have an ally and you are 100% going to have an enemy, but you get to decide who's who.
Maybe there's like a list of 9 traits and you get to assign them amongst these 3 factions. And one is like fucking hates you. One is fucking loves you. Oh, this is good.
Love letters. They're great. Do you have any final words or thoughts on them?
I think, you know, do the Mike Birbiglia thing and write 5 bad moves. Like, if you are into PBTA, or even if you are only curious about it, imagine an archetype or imagine an action that is not in there and just try to write a move for it. And then just roll it a few times and see if it's fun.
Yeah.
And this is not me saying, like, you're all amateurs and I'm the professional. It's just like, this is what my brain does. And if I can get myself excited about every possibility in a game design piece of tech, then I'm like, all right, that's ready to go.
That's great advice.
But there's always a bad draft, and there's always one that's like, well, this choice is not fun. You know, it's the most mid of choices.
Just get rid of that. Yeah.
Just get rid of it. Yeah.
Come up with a better
one. Just be better at game design.
No, but I don't know. Love letters are also really nice in that, like, if you fuck up one of those options, if you put a mid one on there, but like it prompts a interesting discussion, or even if you put an option on there, you know that the person would never ever pick, but it is just sort of like hovering there. That's good design stuff. It starts a conversation.
Oh, games are a conversation.
That's another episode. Aaron King, thanks so much for being on Dice Exploder. It's great hanging out with you.
It was a pleasure. That's it. Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye. So, right after recording, basically, Aaron sent me the love letter we'd started writing on air in its full form, and I thought you might like to hear the whole thing. So, here it is. Dear Ty, when you return from the psychic maelstrom, something follows you. Choose one from each list. List one. It is native to the maelstrom. It is something from before the apocalypse that took refuge in the maelstrom. It is a fellow traveler like you. List two. It has phosphorescent antlers. It shimmers like diesel vinaigrette. It has six limbs ending in human hands. List three. Its coming is heralded by crinkling frost. Bleeding grain plants rise up in its footsteps. Statues and images change to reflect its appearance. Then roll plus weird. On a 10 plus, choose 3. On a 7 to 9, choose 2. On a 6 or less, choose 1, and be prepared for the worst. You know where it is. It will talk to you before it acts. It feels fondly for you. Choose another trait from the lists above. Love and kisses, your MC. Also, before we go, if you liked this episode, you should really check out the ep I did with Nichelle Schneider in the archives about a really similar topic that went to some pretty different places. It's another banger. Okay, thanks again to Aaron for being here. You can find Read the Fucking Manual wherever you get your podcasts, but especially on Patreon, RTFMcast. As always, you can find me on socials at S. Dunnewald or on the Dice Exploder Discord. This episode was edited by Chris Greenbrier. Thank you, Chris! Our logo is designed by Spore Garee, our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray, and our ad music is Lily Pads by my boy, Travis Tesler. And thanks to you for listening. Love and kisses. I'll see you next time.